ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
From an Ipswich fish and chip shop to the epicentre of Australian politics.
Please explain.
Pauline Hanson
one
is
Nation's
making
rise.
It's One Nation.
This is the unlikely story of One Nation.
Well, I'm back.
Is it a passing protest vote or a permanent realignment of Australian politics?
Whether you love her or hate her, truth is stranger than fiction.
The Making of One Nation. To hear the full series, search for The Making of One Nation on ABC Listen.
The sound of the universe. Now, if you subscribe to string theory, your answer might be yes. And look, I don't want to alarm you, but did you know that while the universe is expanding, yes, it could also be unravelling? Welcome to Big Ideas.
It's finite. So something's got to end the universe. And very naturally in our model, we can introduce this dark energy phase that where dark energy and the fact that dark energy starts to dominate the universe is actually a harbinger of doom. And what it's actually suggests is that it's going to hit some maximum amount of expansion. As soon as it starts to become the most important energy content of the universe, it'll start wanting to stop the expansion of the universe. It'll want to turn it round and then drive it towards a big crunch, thereby ending the universe in a finite time.
Yes, never mind climate change or nuclear Armageddon. According to physics, dark energy could end us all. Natasha Mitchell joining you on the ABC Radio National show that brings you big thinkers at the best live events and more of that glorious music from cellist and film composer for movies like After Sun and Pillion, Oliver Coates, at the end of this episode. But let's meet our other big thinker today who'll explain the origins of the universe and theories as to its possible end. Tony Padilla. He's a theoretical physicist and cosmologist at the University of Nottingham and associate director of the new Nottingham Centre of Gravity. He is also presenter of the very popular YouTube series Numberphile and author of a laugh out loud book about mathematics called Fantastic Numbers and Where to Find Them, A Journey to the Edge of Physics, which delves into all sorts of numbers that explain the universe. He joins you today on stage at a Sophia Club live philosophy event in London with the editorial lead for the Sophia Club and editor of the fabulous Eon magazine, Sally Davies. And the conversation, it starts, in the words of the great Julie Andrews, at the very beginning for both Tony and the universe.
Well, we're going to talk this evening about the birth, life and death of the universe. So I think it makes sense to start with your beginnings. So I want to understand how you began life as a physicist. I admit I have listened to a podcast in which you admitted to becoming a physicist because you once got zero on a maths test, which I think gives hope to all of us. So can you talk a little bit about
that? Yeah, sadly, that is true, yeah. So I did maths at uni and it was like first term there and I was doing something called analysis. It doesn't matter what that is, but yeah, I did the problems here and I'd done it really well, I thought. And I'd answered done all these proofs really, really nicely. And then I got the sheet back off the professor at the time and it was just a big fat zero on it. And I was like, seriously, zero? What are you talking about? What have I done? Did I not understand it? And I thought, like, felt like a really bad fraud, like I shouldn't be at university or anything like that. And then it emerged that the reason that he'd given me zero was because the arguments were correct. He just didn't like how I'd lined them up on the paper. And I was like, seriously, mate, is this what it's about? So at that point, I realized that maybe maths was maybe a little too rigorous for me and I need something to bring my sort of love of numbers, which I'd always had, to life. And I, I soon learned that physics was the thing that would bring numbers to life. So bringing those numbers into the physical realm and giving them, you know, something exciting.
So we're going to talk about the universe tonight. And I'm curious to understand, I mean, you can arrive at this answer, one assumes, through numbers in some sense. But what does it mean for the universe to begin? Like, using numbers or empirical data, how can we even start to answer the question of how something emerges from nothingness?
Yeah, so I think people often say, what happened before the Big Bang? What was there before the Big Bang? And that's a bit like asking the question, like, what's north of the North Pole? Like, there is really nothing before. There is no concept of time or space before the beginning. And so it's a completely, doesn't even exist as a proper question. But I think in terms of understanding where the universe comes from nothing, what we've actually learned in recent years is a sort of better idea of what nothing really is. It's, you know, you can think of nothing, it's not the vacuum, it's not empty space, it's really the true absence of space and time itself. And from there, and from that world, you could, that sort of true nothingness, you can imagine a universe being created. And one of the things that the reason that we know that is because we've actually, there is a situation in which nothing can appear as well. So you can have a universe and literally a little bubble of nothing can appear mathematically right in front of you. And it's literally just, it's not like just like there's nothing in there. It's literally an absence of space and time in this bubble. And actually these bubbles can grow, but you can also reverse the process and imagine starting with that nothing and something appearing from it, and that would be the birth of a universe.
But are you telling me, sort of in our day-to-day three-dimensional reality, like bubbles of nothing can sort of pop in and out of existence?
Yeah.
What would happen? Like, how would we know if that were happening in front of us?
Yeah, so it'd be pretty terrifying because it would literally sort of appear, but it's like, so imagine you got those speakers there. Like, suddenly the speakers would suddenly cease to be there, but it wouldn't be that they were just gone. There would be nothing inside there at all. There wouldn't even be air inside it. There wouldn't even be vacuum inside it. There'd just be a nothingness. And what's really scary about this nothingness would literally grow at the speed of light and quickly engulf us, and you would also become part of the nothingness. So yeah, this is a solution. There's a Fields medalist called Ed Witten that found this is an instability of space-time that exists under certain conditions, called its Witten's bubble of nothing, and it can destroy the universe.
Right, an upbeat note with which to begin the evening. So you mentioned the Big Bang, which, you know, I think as many of us in the room will know is probably like our best current theory of how the universe started. Is that right? And are there any other serious contenders for how things got going?
Yeah, no, I think the Big Bang's pretty well established as a theory of the universe. But I think what people talk about the Big Bang is, people always imagine that the Big Bang is sort of going all the way back in time to sort of the point at which, you know, like literally that bubble sort of appeared. But it's not really. Big Bang is actually a statement just for when certain processes had finished and the universe sort of started the current phase that we see. So it's a bit of a lie about what the Big Bang really is. It's not really the beginning. It's a point that appeared a little bit later on after the universe had done some pretty funky stuff, actually.
So, okay, I want to come back to this funky stuff. I mean, I do just want to push you though, and sort of, where did this idea of the Big Bang come from? What evidence do we have for the Big Bang?
Yeah, so the idea of the Big Bang is really just the idea that the universe started out hot and cooled down over time. And the reason it cooled down is because it expanded. If you take a ball of gas and you expand it, it will cool down. It's the same with the universe. You take a very small universe and it grows and expands, then it cools down. And that's just what the hot Big Bang model is. You start off with this hot plasma, the universe grows and everything cools down. And we see some of the effects of that cooling process over time. And we can predict, for example, you know, how much hydrogen and helium there should be in the universe based on this model. And we get the answers spot on. So there's loads of really great empirical evidence to support this. That's why we believe in the model.
So, yeah, tell me about more of the funky stuff then that happened before the Big Bang. Because I think a lot of people think the Big Bang was like ground zero, but you're telling me there was also like a weird prelude to the Big Bang.
Yeah. So one of the other bits of evidence for the Big Bang is something called the cosmic microwave background radiation, which is this leftover radiation, people say, from the Big Bang. It's just a bunch of photons that are streaming through the universe. If you have an old analog telly, I know none of us really have them anymore, but you actually see the cosmic microwave background radiation on your analog telly when you have all that fuzzy, you know, static stuff. And one of the weird things about this radiation is that it's the same in all directions, it's the same temperature in all directions. So if I look at the radiation coming from that end of the universe, it's the same temperature, about 2.7 degrees above absolute zero. If I look at the radiation coming from that end of the universe, it's the same temperature, right? But there's no reason for them to know about each other. There could be little green men at that end of the universe, right, who've never met the little green men, or maybe they're a different color over there, who knows, but you know, the little green men on that end of the universe, they've never been in causal contact. There's no reason for them to ever have communicated with each other. And yet the radiation that's coming from them is coming at the same temperature. And this is a real mystery. And so it was a mystery that needed solving. And for that, we needed this funky stuff before the Big Bang.
And so hang on, I just need to clarify. If I have a cathode ray like TV and I turn it on, I am seeing the remnants of the very beginning of the universe on that television that has been travelling that entire time and it's now on my screen. Wow, that's really wild.
And it's the same in all directions.
Wow, wow. So, okay, another question for you. I understand that there are odds against our universe existing, right? It's like wildly improbable. So, you know, why are we all here blithely existing regardless? What would you say to that as a physicist?
Yeah, I can't answer the question of why we're all here, but I can probably tell you where to look for the answer for why we're all here. And I would say the answer is probably deep inside the centre of a black hole. And the reason for that is that when you go deep inside the centre of a black hole, you get conditions of space and time which are as weird and as wonderful as the conditions of the universe at the moment of its birth. So we talked about how, you know, as the universe evolves over time, it sort of cools down, it expands and cools down. But if you reverse that process, you're sort of shrinking. It's getting hotter. It's getting more and more crazy. The space-time curvature is getting more wild. And that's kind of very much like the conditions at the beginning, at the center of a black hole. So if you want to understand where the universe comes from, you have to understand the physics inside a black hole.
Can you unpack for me why our universe is as unlikely as it is?
I mean, so there's something which I think we're going to comment on to later, which is the energy of empty space, which really should just be much larger than we imagine. And basically, the universe should never have really got past a few sort of, not even milliseconds in time. It should have just been, it should have destroyed itself within almost an instant of creation. It should have just, there should be so much weight to the weight of the universe. When we apply quantum mechanics to our universe, so this wonderful theory of quantum mechanics, which is so well explored, so experimentally well tested, when we apply it to the universe itself, it should make the universe really, really heavy, and it should have crushed the universe out of existence within almost an instant. And it didn't, which is good for us, but it leaves the question of why we were allowed to be here, which is one of the biggest mysteries.
So, okay, this brings me on to a different but related question, which is we started the night hearing from Oliver and his cello strings. Now, you are a devotee of string theory. Now, is the analogy between a cello string and the strings you talk about in string theory, is that just a superficial coincidence or is there something deeper there? Can you tell us what string theory is and the bearing it has on these kind of questions about the birth of the universe?
Yeah, so to come back to the birth of the universe, so I said, like, if you wanted to understand the conditions of space and time at the birth of the universe, it's the same conditions at the center of a black hole. And the thing that you need to do that is you need a theory of gravity, because you're talking about a gravitational setting where, like, black holes and the universe itself. But you also need a quantum theory, which is the theory of basically things that are very small and very high energies. So you need a quantum theory of gravity, and string theory is a quantum theory of gravity. It's the best theory of quantum gravity that we have. It basically just postulates that the building blocks of nature are tiny little vibrating strings, which, rather than particles, you normally think of, you know, when you do physics, you think of everything's made up of particles that are bashing into each other, you know, little billiard boards. But string theory says they're not that. They're not particles, they're strings. And that changes how we understand the beginnings of the universe. You can't get these huge, you can't basically crush anything to smaller than the size of a string. You can't do that. And that sort of cuts off all of these real difficulties associated with the beginning of a universe. And in terms of the cello, it really is the same. The physics of the cello and the physics of the strings of nature are the same things. So the different harmonics that you get on the cello are the same, and in string theory, those different harmonics correspond to what we see as the fundamental particles of nature. So different harmonic of the string will correspond, one will correspond to an electron, one will correspond to, you know, a graviton, one will correspond to a photon. And that's so it's a real fundamental connection, actually.
And so just to kind of reframe what I'm hearing from you, so you mentioned quantum gravity. Now, what you're saying essentially is we've got theory of gravity, which kind of comes from Einstein, and then we've got quantum mechanics, which came from Einstein but others, and both of those are extremely experimentally well-validated, but they do not play nicely together, and no one has figured out how to make them play nicely together. And what you're saying is to explain how the universe started, you need to make them play nicely together, and string theory is one way of doing that, right?
Yeah, exactly. They're like two sort of wonderful but very naughty children when they get together. Like, you know, so together they're just absolutely sweetness and light and lovely. On their own, they're sweetness and light and lovely, but put them together and all chaos breaks.
Sounds like my daily life.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay, so I'm now going to do what I sometimes call the devil's avocado, which is, you know, adopt a contrarian position, not that I necessarily hold, but just to draw out some interesting responses. And so when I was talking to some friends about the fact you're a string theorist, one of them reminded me of a joke from the satirical newspaper The Onion, which was also a favourite of Sean Carroll, the physicist. And the joke goes, a philandering string theorist is caught by his wife in bed with another woman. But darling, he pleads, I can explain everything. And so this is the criticism of string theory is that it's kind of unfalsifiable, right? And that it's enthralled to the beautiful mathematics, but there's no real way of testing it. And, you know, various other problems, like if I'm not mistaken, there's like six extra dimensions that are kind of hidden away. So what say you as defender of string theory?
Yeah, I mean, I'm happy to fire anybody over string theory, basically. So I would say two things. So I'd say this question of whether it's falsifiable, whether it could be experimentally tested, this isn't just something that's true of string theory. This is true of any quantum theory of gravity. And there are other candidates. None of them are as good, of course, but there are other candidates available. But all of them suffer from the same question, that it's really hard to test quantum gravity. It's not just a string theory problem. And the reason is straightforward, right? So when if you want to test things down to very, very small scales, what you need to do is you need to smash stuff together at really, really high energies. That's how you probe really, really short distances. And we just don't have access to the kinds of energies you need to probe the real fabric of space-time, which is what you would do if you would do quantum gravity. We don't have access to that. And that's just true of any theory of quantum gravity. So it's not special to string theory. But there's a real interesting development that's come out of string theory in the last 10 years, which is something called the Swampland program. So the idea is that there was, for a long time, people thought that string theory just predicted pretty much every possibility you could imagine. But that's not true. There are certain things that can't be true in string theory that you can see in day to day. So for example, we often thought that, you know, one of the things that's true in our world is that gravity is a weaker force than all the other forces of nature. It's the weakest force in nature. If that wasn't the case, it would be incompatible with string theory. String theory requires gravity to be the weakest force. So this has all come out of the Swampland program. These criteria, which are true in our day-to-day world, which could only be true if string theory would demand have to be true in some sense. So that's testable. So it could predict something that we just don't see.
It's interesting because it seems to me that people are drawn to string theory, and I think you yourself said to me that part of what drew you to it was the beauty of the mathematics. And it feels like beauty is a very strong guiding principle in the pursuit of scientific truth. I was curious whether, as a physicist, you were aware of any times where the universe had turned out to be ugly. Like, are there cases where the beautiful answer was wrong?
Well, I think it's, I mean, for the most part, I think sort of mathematical beauty, it's not, I think we, as physicists, we all recognize that the mathematical beauty isn't the be all and end all, but it is a powerful tool. And when we don't have access to those experiments, it's something that's worth listening to. And we see how it, you know, the universe does seem to be quite a beautiful place. In terms of whether there's aspects of physics where it's not beautiful. So one of the things that when we think about physics, we think of generally, it's just lots of little vibrating things. So little vibrating particles or vibrating strings, lots of little vibrating things. That's always really nice. That always works out beautifully. The mass is always beautiful, whichever way you do that. When it gets a little bit ugly is when you go beyond that description and you try to sort of imagine a whole thing put together, the great beast of all these little vibrating things, but lots of them put together. That's when it can get a bit ugly. And the reality is we don't really know how to do that kind of physics very well. You know, we just get put off by the ugliness of it, to be honest.
I mean, this is also bringing to mind another terrible dad joke about physicists, where you have a farmer who says, oh, my hens are not laying eggs, what can I do? And the physicist comes in, spends several days thinking about it, and is like, right, I've got got an answer. We just have to assume a perfectly spherical chicken. Look, I think what's really interesting in this conversation about the emergence of space-time, the birth of the universe, for me, what I find very arresting about this is how the behaviour of things at this subatomic level, these like tiny vibrations of strings, these quantum wiggles, somehow determine the macro structure of the universe, of the whole cosmos. How exactly can that be?
Yeah, I mean, well, it's because gravity helps build, basically. So one of the things that's really remarkable, one of my favourite facts in physics, is that literally galaxies emerge from little quantum fluctuations in the very, very early universe before even the Big Bang. So you have this these little quantum wiggles that occur then. The universe stretches out really, really fast. It freezes these wiggles. And then as the universe cools, gravity starts to take over. It starts to see these little excessive little wiggly points that the universe has left over from that initial primordial wiggling of different parts. It spots them, and then gravity sort of grabs them and starts to clump them together. And over essentially, I mean, aeonic time, I mean, if we're going to use the name of the magazine, over really long times, those turn into galaxies. So it's really, I guess, in some ways, the ability of something really, really small, really smaller than anything you can imagine, to turn into a galaxy, is the thing that allows that to happen is time.
The freakish, flukish birth of the universe, as explained by prize-winning theoretical physicist and cosmologist Tony Padilla, who presents the popular YouTube series Numberphile and is a physics professor at the University of Nottingham. ABC Radio National's Big Ideas with me, Natasha Mitchell, comes to you today from London for a Sophia Club live philosophy event which brings together scholars, performers on all the big questions. And they're run in Australia too, by the way. I'm hosting one later this year in Melbourne. We love hearing from you while you're listening. The Radio National text line 0418 226 576. Our email address, bigideas@abc.net.au. Now back to host Sally Davies, who is editor of Eon magazine.
So in this segment, we talked about the birth of the universe, and now we're going to talk about its behaviour in middle age. And like many of us approaching middle age, I understand the universe is also expanding. God, I really am full of dad jokes this evening. I don't know what's come over me. So, okay, so the universe, as I think many of us know, is expanding, and it's also doing so at an accelerating rate, right? So what accounts for that? How can you explain the behaviour of the universe in its current state?
Yeah, so the fact that the universe is expanding at an accelerated rate is really, really weird, by the way. It's not what you'd expect. So the way you can sort of imagine the expansion, people say, well, what's it expanding into? It's not expanding into anything. It is just growing. Literally, the gap between galaxies, if it's you know, that one day, it's going to be a bit more the next day. The gap between, we ignore the fact that the Earth is present and messing things up a little bit, the gap between me and you, Sally, would grow over time. It would just grow. That's the expansion of the universe. The space gets bigger. And you would expect in a gravitational world, well, we know one thing about gravity is that gravity is an attractive force, right? It's keeping us all with our feet on the ground, right? So gravity is very much an attractive force. So you would expect that it would draw things that, okay, expansion can happen, but it should slow down. It should be like trying to stop it going faster. But it's not what happens. We actually see the expansion is speeding up. So that implies that there's something pushing on the universe. And we don't know what it is, so we just give it a name. So we just come up with a name. There's a culprit who we don't know about that's responsible for something like, you know, something like Jack the Ripper. In this case, we call it dark energy. That's the thing that's responsible for pushing the universe apart at an accelerated rate. And it's something that we see happening. We discovered this about the late 90s, that there was this mysterious substance pushing the universe apart at an ever-increasing rate.
And you mentioned before the energy of empty space, right? So the fact that we've observed that a perfect vacuum with absolutely nothing in it nonetheless has some energy. Is that the same as dark energy?
It could be. It could be. So empty space, it's kind of weird that empty space has energy at all, right? You would expect it. Why would empty space? There's nothing there. It's a pure vacuum. Why? It's clearly got no energy. That seems like crazy. But actually it does. It's because it's due to quantum mechanics. One of the things about quantum mechanics is it never really allows anything to truly settle down. There's always a probability. Quantum mechanics is laced with the idea of uncertainty and probabilities. So there's always inherent uncertainty in a system. And what that means is there's even an uncertainty in the amount of energy that it stores, even in a true vacuum. So you should think of the vacuum not as something that's just boring and empty, but is actually a bubbling broth of virtual particles popping in and out of existence.
Can I stop you? What's the difference between an actual particle and a virtual particle?
Yeah, so a real particle is a particle you can grab. So you can literally grab it with your hand and say, hey, there you go, there's an electron, right? A virtual particle you can never actually grab. It can happen in some intermediate process, but you're never reaching in and grabbing it. The minute you grab it, it becomes real. Okay, it's really just a fancy language to say stuff that can happen in between the endpoints, right? So you've got particles coming in, you've got particles coming out, there can be all sorts of stuff going on in the middle that we can't actually interact with. That's a virtual particle.
So is this kind of that kind of uncertainty principle idea, the sort of Schrodinger's cat being alive and dead? It's like the virtual particle is the cat that's alive and dead at the same time before we
in a way,
it.
Yeah. There's a huge level of uncertainty in the system itself. And when you sort of calculate the net effect of that uncertainty on the energy of the space, you actually get this leftover amount, okay? So when I say dark energy could be the energy of empty space, but there's a big, big problem. And the big, big problem is that when we calculate how much energy there should be in empty space, it's way too much. And I'm really talking like way too much. If I take a coffee cup of empty space, and I ask how much energy does quantum mechanics should tell me be stored inside that coffee cup? It's enough energy to destroy every planet in every solar system, in every galaxy, in the entire universe, billions and billions and billions and billions and billions and billions and billions of times over. It's a remarkable amount of energy in one coffee cup of empty space. That's what quantum mechanics predicts. And if that's how much energy is in empty space, there's no way it can be dark energy, because that amount of energy in empty space would destroy the universe.
So what accounts for that discrepancy?
Yeah, it was one of the biggest mysteries in physics, because what dark energy tells us, it could be the energy of empty space, but the amount would have to be far less. So it's like quantum mechanics is telling us that empty space should have this huge amount of energy. Dark energy, if it is empty space, is telling us actually the amount of energy in a coffee cup is nothing like that crazy amount that quantum mechanics is telling you. It's something much less. So there's a mismatch. There's got to be a correction. Where's the correction coming from? Well, it can come. One of the things that we might imagine is there's some sort of, maybe there's some fundamental aspect of physics which just feeds the correction to us, something that comes from maybe string theory, something more fundamental. So you can have your quantum corrections or your quantum contribution, but it's not the full story. You've got that. You've got two baskets, if you like. You've got your basket from quantum mechanics, which tells you there's that much energy in empty space. And then there's another basket, which is going to contribute to the energy of empty space as well, coming from, say, string theory or something fundamental. And it's the combination that you measure. And so that basket might be really heavy. Oh, and this basket is also really heavy, but negatively heavy. And you combine them and you get something really small. But that's a really unlikely balancing act. It's in fact the most ridiculous balancing act that in nature. You've got these two baskets and they balance to within one part in 10 to the 120, which is one with 120 zeros after it.
So what you're saying is like it's more likely that they would be wildly out of whack or maybe even perfectly balanced, but the fact that we have this like the tiny amount of energy that's left over that is the right amount to push the universe apart at the pace we're observing, that teeny little vestige is the thing that makes our universe so unlikely.
Exactly. So if you imagine again these two baskets, the basket from quantum mechanics and let's say for the sake of argument the basket from string theory, they weigh whatever they weigh and you combine them and they're just going to come to some overall, not much cancellations going on, but there is this remarkable cancellation and it's a huge mystery as to why it that happens.
So okay.
And it has to happen.
So to recap, what we've got is we've got a universe that shouldn't exist, driven apart by a force that we can't really explain, that's massively out of kilter with the mathematics. And this has led to a number of different proposals, I understand. And one is like the multiverse. Like, if there's a huge number of universes, we just happen to live in the one that, like, randomly turned out to be just balanced in this, or just imbalanced in the right way. But you're an advocate of a different idea. You have put forward this notion that this kind of wild improbability can nonetheless exist in the framework of a single universe.
Yeah, yeah. Can I explain the multiverse first quickly? Yeah, yeah. So the multiverse scenario, basically, we go back to the basket analogy. You've got your quantum mechanics basket. That's huge. And then what the multiverse scenario is the other basket, which is, say, coming from string theory. There are just lots of... Each universe has its own basket coming from string theory. And there are many, many of them. And it just so happens that in one universe, the balancing acts happened, even though normally it doesn't. Okay, that's the multiverse scenario. The scenario that we imagined is a bit like there's a dial in the universe. There's like a sort of thermostat. The energy of empty space can set the temperature of the universe, actually. That's one of the things it does. It sets the overall temperature of the universe. And we imagined that in some sense, it's like the universe was born with a thermostat, which sets the temperature. And if you start messing around with different contributors that try to change the temperatures, like, then it's going to try and correct it. It'll bring something in to correct it. It's very much just like a fridge where you've got a fridge, it's set to a certain temperature, you put something inside it, you bring up the temperature of the fridge, and then suddenly the condenser starts going on and it tries to bring the temperature of the fridge down. There's an external effect which brings the temperature of the fridge down. We imagine that with the universe. So you can imagine that there's a thermostat which is setting the temperature of the universe. You can bring in whatever you like, all your energy of empty space. You can even bring planets, everything, whatever. It doesn't matter. The temperature has to be set by this thermostat, which means there has to be an external agent come in, like the condenser of the fridge, which is going to dial the temperature back down. And that's what we imagined. So we took this analogy further and we developed an extension of Einstein's theory, which could implement this in a natural way.
So what's setting the thermostat from outside the universe?
Yeah, so we have no mechanism to set in the thermostat. What we do is, our achievement is we're able to control these unruly quantum corrections, the quantum basket is the problem. That in itself is a hard thing to control, and we're able to control it with our thermostat. So in that sense, it's already an achievement. In terms of what sets the temperature of the, what sets the value of the thermostat, there's nothing in our theory which would do that, but nor do we expect it to. So something about the... To understand that, you would have to go to a higher theory. You would have to try to understand how our theory emerged from something like string theory, which would hopefully give you the temperature of the thermostat for free. But just having the thermostat and controlling those quantum corrections is a significant advantage. There's something else
that has a thermostat that isn't a fridge, and that's all of us here in the room tonight, right? So evolution has selected us to keep our body temperature within a certain range, like through this process of homeostasis. So I'm just wondering... Does this idea of a thermostat being baked into the universe, does that lead you to believe that perhaps there's like some sort of selection process going on, like generations of universes that get selected to have a thermostat so that they can survive?
I mean, I think you can apply some sort of like what we call anthropic reasoning to this to some extent. So if you can imagine, for example, this takes us back to the multiverse. In some sense, you can imagine that, okay, we only experience one corner of it. We only experience one thermostat. But you could imagine there's lots of different universes and they each have a different setting for the thermostat, right? Now, in most universes, the thermostat's just going to be set to some crazy hot value, right? And in those universes where it's set to some crazy hot value, the conditions are so hostile that space-time just gets torn apart. You never get stars, planets forming. And if you never get stars and planets forming, you guys aren't getting formed either, okay? So there's no intelligent people looking around wondering why the universe looks the way it does, okay? But there could potentially be some universes where the thermostats are just set to the right value, where actually, that's nice. That's a nice, cool universe, right? And cool in every way, not just cool temperature-wise, cool otherwise, because it allows stars and planets to grow, and on those stars and planets, you get people, and those people ask interesting questions. So that might be where it comes from. So in that sense, it links to I think, those ideas about evolution.
The universe, it's just one big fridge. incredible theories to explain the cosmos from Tony Padilla, host of the popular YouTube series Number File and a physics professor at the University of Nottingham, joining you on Big Ideas Today with me, Natasha Mitchell, on ABC Radio National and ABC Listen from this Sophia Club live philosophy event in London with host Sally Davies. Now, we've covered the origins of the universe and what it's up to right now. How's it all going to end then?
So we're going to conclude this last section of the conversation tonight by talking about the cheerful subject of death. So I'm curious for you to kind of sketch out a menu of options for the end of the universe. But before we get to what physicists actually think, I want to take some of the suggestions from the audience and for you to kind of cash out the physics of what that might look like. So, all right, so one idea, which actually to me sounds quite plausible, the Higgs boson will quantum tunnel from its current held state so everything instantaneously dissolves into nothingness. Could that actually happen?
Yes, that's a real one. Yeah, it absolutely is. So the Higgs boson, which obviously, if people have followed what's happened, in is this, you know, fantastic subatomic particle, which we talk about as giving everything its mass, but it's like giving everything mass in the universe. That's a bit of a lie, but we'll run with it anyway. But one of the things about it is that it's, it is potentially unstable. And it could, what could happen is it could indeed tunnel quantum mechanically to a new phase. So what that means is that literally everywhere in the universe, the Higgs just would just suddenly spontaneously change what it is. And there's a quantum mechanical probability that this can happen. The mass of the Higgs is such that we think that it's on the verge of being unstable. So it's right on the boundary.
That's reassuring.
Yeah. And if it were to happen, yeah, then literally the Higgs would, if the Higgs changes what it is, then that changes what we mean by everything in terms of like what the electron is, what protons are, because it's basically the Higgs really controls the physics of all the other fundamental particles. If the Higgs changes, then everything changes.
And would that just require a single Higgs boson, or would like every Higgs in the universe change at the same time?
So what I think that person's talking about is really what's the Higgs field,
right,
which is everywhere in the universe, yeah.
Okay, let's hope that doesn't happen. All right, another proposal will reach a point of existence where it's like putting your face up against a mirror and everything will freeze in a permanent reflection of itself, and then that's it.
Yeah, I mean, that's kind of a little bit like the heat death, right, in a way. It's sort of like just a real sort of frozen end to the universe where nothing interesting ever happens ever again. It's really boring end to the universe.
And, but that's like an eternal universe forever.
Yeah,
and
it's
then
frozen, right?
Just once. So this was like a one-shot thing and let's all have a party while it's on, but then for the rest of time, it's kind of blank and cold and nothing.
Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm.
Also very cheerful. Okay, yeah. Excellent.
You're talking about death, right?
Yeah. Okay, well, how about this one? Tell me about the physics of this. The universe will be consumed by the flying spaghetti monster in the sky.
Yeah, I mean, could that happen? Well, I mean, spaghetti monsters. I mean, in a way, when you dive into a black hole, right, we all turn into spaghetti monsters when we dive into a black hole, right?
Nice, okay.
Yeah. Because there's a process called spaghettification, which is literally, as you're at the center of a black hole, we have this horrible region, which we talked about earlier. It's called the singularity, where the gravitational force actually becomes infinite there. So if you're diving into a black hole and you're diving in feet first, then the gravitational pull near your feet is going to be loads stronger than the gravitational pull near your head as you approach this singularity. So you get stretched out like spaghetti. So you become the spaghetti monster itself. Whether you then have the ability to go and end the universe is somewhat moot, because you're going to end pretty soon after that anyway yourself.
I mean, you've made the argument, right, that if on long enough timescales, it's possible that we could all find ourselves here a second time round, like doing exactly what we're doing in this room now. So like theoretically on long enough timescales, couldn't you find a reality where there's a flying spaghetti monster in the sky that could destroy reality? Like that's, you know, mathematically necessary.
Probably is actually. Yeah, I would say so. Because there's something else in that we talk about in this sort of context is something called Boltzmann brains, which are the idea that you're much more likely to be a brain floating around empty space with fake memories that you've just created for yourself than actually you, what you are now. And actually, when you do some of the statistics of cosmology, this turns out to be true. So an empty brain floating in empty space or a sort of violent spaghetti monster. I mean, take your pick, right?
Is this kind of related to the theory that we're all living inside a computer game or a simulation?
It's not related to that. It's just when you start applying the idea of an eternal universe when you start to try to do the mathematics of that, you start to get these really wild paradoxes coming out, like things like you're much more likely to be a random fluctuation of a really dull and empty and tedious universe than something much more exotic like what we see around us.
Okay, I'm going to pick one more from the audience, which is the universe, meaning one, will end when it divides like an amoebum into two and then four and then exponentially onwards. Are there any like respectable physicists who think that's what's going to happen?
I think you could make sense of that. Yeah. One of the models of the universe that we could have is, you mentioned earlier that string theory exists with six extra dimensions that we don't see. That people normally think of them as wrapped up very, very small. But there is another possibility, and that's that our universe corresponds to like a three-dimensional membrane, and then there's this sort of sea of six extra dimensions. So it's like a membrane, like moving in some sea of extra dimensions. And actually, what you can have is, and string theory totally predicts these things, you can have these membranes sort of lying on top of each other, okay? And then they can, and that can be our universe, right? But they can split and they can remove, leave one. So you literally have two on top of each other and then they split. And you can then start to feel the effects of the other one. So maybe you're left on one, right? But the other one's still there. How might you feel it? Well, you're only going to feel it through the effects of gravity. So it could be something that we talk about as dark matter, which is this matter that we think is around us, that we can't see, but we can feel its gravitational effects. Well, one possibility is it could be matter on one of these other membranes. So if that is the end of the universe, the presence of dark matter might indicate that we're already there.
Wow. So what you're saying is like, this in string theory, this is kind of like my six-year-old might draw stick figures on a two-dimensional stick figures on a piece of paper, but that those two-dimensional stick figures exist in three-dimensional space. And
exactly.
So like we are like the stick figures existing in this multi-dimensional reality on the surface of a piece of paper.
Exactly. I normally talk about it like sort of like you've got walls and we're like ants on a wall in a sea in an extra dimensional room, and that's our world. But then you can have the bits of wallpaper peel off, and that would be your amoebas.
Wild. Well, look, it's good to know that we've got some expert physicists in the house, because it sounds like these theories, could be stood up. All right. So look, I want to talk about the fact that it's obviously pretty tough being you, Tony. You know, being a theoretical physicist, you rarely get new data that can kind of test or stretch your theories. But what's really exciting about this moment that we live in is that is actually happening with things like the James Webb Telescope, which allows us to peer back into literally almost moments after the Big Bang. And also, more relevantly for our conversation, this data that's come out from what's called the Dark Energy Spectroscopic Instrument, or DESI, which has produced the biggest map ever of the observable universe. And in fact, the picture on tonight's event was, every single little dot on that was a galaxy, which is pretty extraordinary. But one of the things that's really interesting to come out of that is it's also surfaced this unsettling finding that dark energy seems to be decreasing over time. So how does that change our picture of the cosmos?
So we talked earlier about dark energy could be the energy of empty space, albeit some very nicely balanced one where the two baskets come in and balance in almost perfect unison. But if that happens, dark energy could be the energy of empty space. If it is the energy of empty space, then it's constant. It doesn't change over time. It just stays what it is, and eventually it comes to dominate the universe as the rest of the energy density of space, of stars and planets starts to dilute. You're just left with this sort of residual energy of empty space spread right across the universe that dominates the universe, albeit it's only a very small amount. But that's not what we're seeing evidence that actually dark energy is evolving over time. That's what the DESI collaboration have seen, that it's slowly changing in some weird and wonderful ways, actually. There's evidence that even during the early universe, not the time exactly today, but a little bit earlier, not right in the early universe, but at an earlier stage, that actually the DESI collaboration saying dark energy actually went through what's called a phantom phase, where it starts to behave in a really strange way, where actually it's pushing, in that phase, it's causing dark energy to grow. It's pumping energy into the dark energy system. And this is really weird. It's very hard to describe that microscopically. And then it changes its character, and now it's going into this other stage where it's still evolving and, as you say, potentially decreasing over time.
So your idea of this universe that has a thermostat, it actually, conveniently for you, does imply that there's this changeable dark energy, right? So what does this imply for the lifespan of the universe and its possible demise?
Yeah, so one of the things that that our thermostat model required is that because we think about the universe as a whole, and when I say as a whole, I just don't mean all of space, I also mean all of time. We're required to think of the universe on those terms. And the minute you start talking about all of time, you then have to say, well, how much time is there? Are we talking about an infinite amount of time or a finite amount of time? If you're talking about an infinite amount of time, then our math starts to get a bit dodgy. So to avoid getting shouted at by our fellow physicists, well, they shout at us anyway, but avoid getting shouted at by the fellow physicists, one of the things that we say is, well, actually, it should predict that the universe only exists for a finite amount of time. So that means it's finite. So something's got to end the universe. And very naturally in our model, we can introduce this dark energy phase, that where dark energy and the fact that dark energy starts to dominate the universe is actually a harbinger of doom. And what it's actually suggests is that it's going to hit some maximum amount of expansion. The dark energy, it sort of, as soon as it starts to become the most important energy content of the universe, it'll start wanting to turn to stop the expansion of the universe. It'll want to turn it round and then drive it towards a big crunch, thereby ending the universe in a finite time.
So how much longer have we got, Tony?
Yeah, so don't want to upset people, but one of the funny things that so other people have thought about crunching universes, universes which reach some maximum size and then start to crunch back on themselves. So we're not the first people to come up with that. But one of the things that's true generically, and I hadn't really realized this until I started to think more about actually crunching models, is that the idea of a big crunch, these universes tend to behave like roller coasters. So what do I mean by that is that the universe grows, it starts to expand, and it's sort of chugging slowly up the roller coaster. You know, you chug, 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 but you're sort of getting more and more nervous. It's like, this is how like the universe slowly expanding. And then you reach the top of the expansion, and then it's straight down, super fast. And this is generically how expanding and contracting cosmological models play out, unfortunately. So the expansionist phase is much more slow than the crunching phase. Having said that, this is all done on cosmological timescales. So we're probably still talking orders of billions of years between reaching the, you know, the top and then crunching back to zero. But yeah, on cosmological time, it's the end tends to be faster, less time than the start.
Interesting. So if humanity manages to cling on like a barnacle to the universe right to the end, how would we actually experience the end of the universe? Like, what would we start to see?
For a long time, not much. The astronomers would be the first people that spotted it, right? So they'd start to see, rather than galaxies receding away from us, they'd start to come towards us. That's kind of the obvious thing, right? And so, you know, that might cause some panic among some people, but you might think it's a localized effect. But when you realized it wasn't a localized effect, then you can start to run deeper. And eventually, of course, the galaxies would start to collide. Okay, so you'd start to see galaxies colliding, probably black holes forming, that sort of thing. Probably through those collisions of galaxies, we'd be ejected from the galaxy, actually. That's probably a likely scenario. But if that didn't happen, eventually all the matter in the universe is going to clump together. You'd start to see planets coming closer and closer together. Realistically, the universe is going to start getting really hot at that point. Because remember, an expanding universe cools down, a contracting universe heats up. So the universe is going to get hotter, which means eventually you're just going to boil. Okay, it's not going to be possible for your the ambient temperature of the universe is going to become so high that you're just not going to be able, your body's not going to be able to cope with it anymore, and then eventually you're, you know, even the particles that make you up can no longer be stable. The Higgs will jump out of its vacuum position. That will happen at that point, definitely. That'll go into reverse because we know that the Higgs did move in the early universe, so we're going to expect it to move back in this late universe scenario as the temperature goes up, and everything eventually we. Even the concept of a particle would disappear. We'd end up in a situation very similar again to what life's like at the center of a black hole or at the moment of creation. And we'd basically be going right back to being, the universe would be very much like it was as a baby.
So is there any way out of that? I mean, there are a few questions that I'm going to actually wrap up into one. There's a lot of interest from the audience about theories of a cyclical universe that, you know, several people have mentioned Roger Penrose and his theories. What do you think is likely to happen after the end of the universe as we know it?
So I think trying to understand if the crunch model is correct, if that is our fate, then I think it's very, very hard. I think cyclic models, so the idea of a cyclic model is that you'd go through a crunch and then once you've crunched, then that would suddenly, you'd start to expand again. So you'd sort of go down and then up again and down and then up again. Now, the problem is you're crunching over regions of space-time which are essentially zero. And we just don't know how to do the physics of that at the moment. String theory potentially could give us an answer to that, but that seems really hard to do. The other problem with cyclic models is that the universe, one of the things we know to be true is that entropy, you mentioned entropy right at the start of today, entropy, this idea of disorder, one of the things we know is that that grows over time. And if you had a cyclic universe, then the entropy of the universe would just be growing, 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 growing. And the entropy of the universe would be way too big, right? So it would be much bigger than the entropy of the universe that we would see today. So it's hard to sort of rationalize a highly cyclic universe with the amount of entropy that we see.
But if time as we know it ends when the universe crunches in, wouldn't that kind of reset the entropy ratchet back to zero?
I think you would have to understand that moment of transition point much better. Mm-hmm. I don't think we do at the moment, mm-hmm. unfortunately.
So I've got a really nice question here from Jenna, which is a version of what I wanted to ask as well, which is kind of about how working with physics at the scale of billions and potentially trillions of years changes the way you live your life day to day, if at all. Should it change the way we live ours? How should it matter to us emotionally or philosophically whether or not the universe ends?
Yeah, I mean, I could answer this in a deep way. I could answer it in an honest way. So honestly, the way I sometimes think about cosmological timescales is, and I think I mentioned this to you before, Sally, is I worry that there's going to be all this cosmological time during which Liverpool might win football matches and I won't see them. And that's slowed. But yeah, I think you were probably wanting something deeper than that, right?
Well, I don't know. Does it? I mean, it's interesting. Do you feel that your day-to-day existence as a little ant on a brain embedded in higher dimensional space, does that affect sort of the way you view hardship or encounter difficulty, the way you manage your relationships, or are they just kind of separate dimensions, as it were?
I think I find it quite easy to sort of just become abstract in it and sort of just almost get lost in the abstraction of it. And you, whilst I mean, I mentioned at the start the idea that I like to bring sort of, you know, physics into the abstract world of number. But at some level, you are just dreaming. And I think it may be a bit like music in some sense. You allow yourself to get carried away by it and just to think in a plane which maybe isn't that connected to your day-to-day life. And honestly, I don't know if I care that it is, and I'm okay with that.
I would just like you to join me in thanking our speaker and performer tonight for a truly electrifying evening, as well as our production staff for making everything run so smoothly. So thank you so much for being part of it.
Wondrous theories to explain it all and to make the most of it all, right? As mere specks in this big, mysterious universe. With thanks to prize-winning theoretical physicist and cosmologist Tony Padilla from the University of Nottingham and its Centre of Gravity. You can watch Tony on YouTube. He has a series, it's called Number File, or read his book, Fantastic Numbers and Where to Find Them, A Journey to the Edge of Physics. He was speaking at the Sophia Club, bringing live philosophy ideas, culture and performance to venues in London, New York and Melbourne. which is where I'll be hosting one later this year. Join us. Thanks to today's host, Sally Davies, who is the Sophia Club's editorial lead and editor of Eon Magazine. My name is Natasha Mitchell. Big Ideas is produced by Claire Slattery, Karin Zivanovitz and me, with sound engineer David LeMay. You can email us too. We love hearing from you. bigideas@abc.net.au. And we'll leave you with more string theory of the musical variety with acclaimed film composer, electronic music producer and cellist Oliver Coates.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.